Do we just start talking?
I don't know.
Do an intro? I haven't really thought this far. I was just walking again.
Well, you want to start with maybe what we were doing out there, which was just casually brainstorming, pretending like this stuff doesn't even exist, and then move into it or not, I like or it. I don't know. Your show.
So we're talking.
Okay.
Good to see you, Mike.
Here we are. Good to see you, Nick.
I'm so glad you're here in Chicago.
This is great to be in Chicago. It's been forever.
It all started as a joke, I think.
Yeah,
hey, Paul, do you want to maybe get Mike out here for half res? And he said yes. Mm-hmm. So you're here.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
So I figured we'd get in the room here. We're in the podcast room. It's very visual. We got our rabbit with a mustache. We got our
crazy maze ball.
We'll challenge that later.
Right.
But I figured we'll come in and just talk about whatever's going on. And we started talking a little bit before we turned the mics on. But thinking about, let's start with this. What got you originally into motion graphics? Like not the first motion graphics thing. Maybe the way to ask this is, can you see something from your past or your childhood that you can thread through to the present that got you into motion graphics?
No.
No? Mm-hmm. It's good to see you.
have a good night.
Well, I'm seeing this marble thing. We just pulled this in for visuals. Mm-hmm. And I actually, this was my entire childhood, was like marble games.
Right.
There was a game called Marble Works. There was all these dynamic dominoes, Domino mm-hmm. Rally. Like, those were the toys I was always, like, drawn to.
Things with motion and kinetic sort of motion sculptures.
And basically, as soon as Dynamics came out for Cinema 4D, uh-huh. that triggered something in the back of my brain that was like, this is all I want to do now, is just set up dominoes mm-hmm. and hit play and watch it move and let that happen. And so I tend to see, and maybe that's revisionary history, you look back and kind of pull things forward, only the stuff that makes sense. But is there anything from your past that you can see and go, that actually maybe not got you into motion graphics, but informs the way that your brain works
right
these days?
I think that was the weird, I didn't mean to be difficult there. The the part with motion graphics is just that it's such a small subset of what I consider being creative by default or something, or like actively creative. And I would completely agree, puzzles. I mean, there's just no doubt puzzles were part of my youth, and then sculptural puzzles, Legos, Lincoln Logs, Bristle Blocks, all those dead toys that don't blink anymore. What a joke.
So you have a theater background.
Yeah, I do.
And I remember talking a few years back a little bit about it. But how do you see any connections between your like past theater life or and what you do now, or anything that moves forward with that?
Yeah, absolutely. The theater part, actually, I got introduced to theater through my father, because he used to be a recording engineer when he was young, and then to make money, he had to get a real job. I don't know, or it was a selective job. He had to be really good. So he left it, but then he always really liked it, and he wanted to continue doing it, so he would do stuff with the community theater in order to do sound, just to keep it going.
Oh,
so
okay.
He took me down to the theater, and while he was doing sound or building sets or whatever, then I was really young and got a chance to be exposed to it. I remember the first time I saw like a telephone ring from off stage, and I was like, that is so cool. And
I actually never thought. So how do you get a telephone ring from off stage?
Well, that's, you send it voltage. I don't know. Do you want to?
No, this is amazing.
There's a thing called, I actually have one of these, it's harder than you think, especially if you're using an old-timey telephone the newer ones, clearly, but like the older ones run some higher voltages than just like 5 volts, like modern digital electronics or anything. But you can take, there's a thing called a telecue, that's made for that, and it just does it at the right amount. Somebody just hits the button and then it rings.
Make the phone ring.
Yeah.
So now I'm thinking, back when there were phones on the wall, those didn't have power.
Yes, they do.
I mean, they had
they have power.
They had plug-in power. Like,
yeah, when you plug it into the wall, there is actually current coming through from the phone company.
In the phone line.
In that phone line.
Are you serious?
In fact, there's some guys that had done some hacks recently that were like, hey, if there's an emergency, this is a way to charge devices through the phone line. And then they got ripped online saying that they were like, that's irresponsible. You know, phones are for an emergency. That's not your power. You know, this is unethical.
No
and
kidding.
Yeah, there's some old timey guys that were just like, weren't having it at all. But yeah, you can do that.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm learning a lot. Okay, yeah. So that powered, I guess that makes sense. That powered the ringer.
Yeah.
That powered all that stuff.
And then you need, you need some voltage in order to amplify your voice and send it back. I mean, it has to travel over something. It has to travel over electricity. I don't know what you thought was in the line. But there are some. Actually, there's a really interesting type of phone.
Okay.
That, it all starts with like a carbon paper or something like that. And then the vibration from the carbon paper is doing all, you know, transferring into electrical signals. But I'd read about a Navy phone, a phone that the Navy uses, that is powered by the sound of your voice.
Oh, wow.
That, like, somehow, and that's made for emergencies in case electricity goes down. They also have analog or mechanical computers, which are awesome.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen those, but they've got, like, these, like, artillery. You need to, like, calculate the trajectory of a parabola or something like that.
Got it.
And it's just like a series of gears which are put together in the same way that you would do like a normal function.
It's like in a suitcase.
And
like kind of all mechanical.
Something like that. It's just like set up. But like if there's a fire like inside of the ship, that thing does not go down. You can still do it. You can still fire the guns and all that
Holy
stuff.
Crap.
So I got really into like the sort of technological stuff that the military had just because it's they solve problems. Mostly to kill people, but they solve problems.
They're highly motivated to solve the problem.
Yeah.
So I never thought about electricity in a phone line. I'm an idiot. I could see it now. I mean, everything's electricity, right?
Sure.
We're talking, this is all...
That's the funniest part, is that, like, if you ask people, like, how does electricity work, you know? Like, maybe, like, electrons, something, atoms, I don't know, kind of. But all of us use it every day, right?
Right, and it's instantaneous, which is what I... Which really makes my brain hurt, which is across, like, you make a phone call, I'm saying it, you hear it within
milliseconds,
right?
But milliseconds are not instantaneous. And the more you work with milliseconds, you realize that that's not instantaneous.
Oh, okay. Let's get into it. Yeah. I understand it's not perfect.
Sure.
Even right now, we're not, I'm speaking, it's going through air, and it's hitting your ear later.
Sure.
Because of sound and all, but, this is, I don't know why I'm thinking about this. I always thought it was cool that if you're in a baseball game and you're listening to the baseball game up in the bleachers on your little radio, your little battery-powered radio, that you'll hear the bat hit the ball first through the radio before you'll hear it through the sound without a delay on a live game. So the actually going into the radio, sending it out radio waves will get to you faster than the sound waves in the stadium.
You got experimental proof of that?
I do.
Okay.
I do. And so
that's interesting.
So like the once it's electric, right? It's traveling faster than in sound waves, which are whatever 600 miles an hour or something like that. Is that sound?
I can't remember the speed of sound.
It's not fast,
but it's not that fast. It's like something. It's less than 1,000 miles an hour.
Yeah. I mean, it's I can't go to those big stadium concerts anymore because of it. I mean, if I see Neil Peart hit the snare drum and I hear it half a second later, I'm out of it.
Furious.
I'm furious.
I'm enraged.
I can't.
I want my money back.
I want, and you can't. I have to. Maybe they can invent goggles that delay the visuals.
Well, here's something to just screw it all up. You've heard about like neurological signals. I feel like I've seen a couple of things on TV about how quickly you sense pain or heat, and that there's actually quite a delay between when you touch something and then when it registers. But then there were either other experiments where they were claiming that you actually sense it before it happens, which gets into some weird stuff. I would probably not bring too much up of it right now because I can't remember all this stuff. There is somewhere, but it's not in my body or my head. I saw it, and it looked compelling.
So we sense pain before it happens? Like we're seeing the future?
I shouldn't have even brought it up.
No, this is interesting.
There's instances. All I'm saying is that there's instances in terms of delay, that perceptual delay, that we're not really even all that aware of.
So this is like more than five senses kind of stuff, right? Uh-huh. Where we're like electromagnetic and
possibly
whatever, or dimensional. This can get really hairy if we go down this path.
Yeah. you want to reel it back in?
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you probably even deal with delays in, we probably don't do that much electronic music stuff, but when you're using syncing digital instruments together, there's always latency is what they call it, you know, that you have to, and it's always within milliseconds. And
my first Pro Tools rig was, so before Pro Tools, I just did tape, which had zero latency, basically. You little four-track cassette tape, you record on the tracks, listen to it back, play guitar, play drums over it, never had a problem. Got Pro Tools, digital latency, right? And it was a lot. I mean, it was like 100 milliseconds
That's
to 1,000 milliseconds, and you could pick it.
1,000 milliseconds is a second.
It's a second. But it had, it was in milliseconds.
Okay,
and you could pick your latency, and the longer delay you gave it, the more accurate it would be, and the more tracks you could. I mean, this is on a G3 or G4 Mac, so it didn't have a lot of power. So anyway, what I'm saying is, latency sucks. So I go get this Pro Tools rig, and now I got to figure all this stuff out. Well, and they do the latency for you, and they'll back it up and basically backdate everything you play to on time. But as soon as you get to live performance with latency, you're screwed. We're back to the Neil Peart problem again.
What's the Neil Peart problem?
Oh, you see him, and then you hear it.
Well, why is that such a problem anyway? Can't you just adjust it in your mind?
Not when you're playing against your own band.
So, say for instance, you're looking at a television screen and somebody's half off the screen. Does that make you furious that you can't see the other half of them?
Me, it's like, okay, if I play drums, and I'm laying a beat down,
and then
I come back and I pick up a guitar and I play on top of that beat. I'm off.
Right, but why don't you just look at it as something that's out of phase?
That's hard. It's hard for me to see it because I just have to hear it. I'm more like audio. It was same with when the drumming game came out, like Rock Band, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they came out with the drums, and I'm like, I'm going to kill this thing. I know how to play drums.
You bought that thing?
No, my friend had it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Everyone's friend had it. And I sat
down. None of my friends had it.
And I'm like, this is real drums. This is awesome. I'm going to kill it. And pulled up a song, and what happened was the TV was out of delay with the sound.
Right.
And I failed instantly because I only listened to the audio, and I didn't see the lines.
That's
right?
Just a sense of unfairness. Like, you wanted to, you deserved.
I kind of needed to win.
Be a guitar hero or rock band hero or whatever it is.
That difference, I have no clue what we're even talking about now.
But latency.
The difference between, I saw you working on some audio stuff out there. To bring it a little bit back, you've been playing with audio ever since I've seen your tutorials. You've always had an interest in audio. Does that come from like your dad and that background and the theater and all that stuff?
Yeah, you know, my dad didn't actually teach me a lot about audio, but there were like a couple of things in the very beginning when I think I bought my first cassette, he shamed me. He's like, what are you doing buying cassettes? That is so low. Buy a record. Which you can actually, I don't know, people want to say vinyl now all the time, but he did actually say record.
Did he want you to make a tape?
He wanted me to buy a record and then copy it to tape.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can understand if there's other things that, like, you wouldn't do a master, like, JPEG or something like that in a compressed format. Like, you would never, edit in with compressed work in motion graphics or anything like that. It was a decent lesson. But he also had a reel-to-reel, and he was, that, which is becoming just about appropriately vintage right now. I think you've seen that they've got new ones that they're rebuilding.
Really? Do they have the tape out?
Yeah.
My thing was they were losing all the tape.
The tapes were gone? Yeah, I feel like there's a small resurgence for it. I heard they got some desktop models now that are just like...
Just doing that.
Yeah, just for the...
I used to bounce to tape on a reel-to-reel on all my stuff. Even in Pro Tools, my last final bounce would be to reel-to-reel two-track, and I'd saturate the heck out of it and get this nice compression. It's real nice. And then kick it back digital and master the MP3 from there. And that actually worked.
The thing is that I don't really get along very well with audiophiles for the most part. People that complain or will incessantly bitch about the fact that records sound better than tape and stuff like that. Because I always say, you know, well, what room are you in? What speakers do you have? You know, they just don't sound good by default. Yeah. And then you'll, you know, somebody who's like, oh, I can't believe you're putting ice in your whiskey. I'm like, you just ate like garlic spaghetti. Like that has more of a change on like your whiskey drinking than the ice. Are you kidding me? You know, right. So it's really understanding that they all work together, sound and all that stuff works together.
Well, it's real ceremonial and it's real personal and all that stuff, right?
But like, it gives you something to do besides learn about what's going on. You just kind of like, it just seems like showy, you know?
It seems for audiophile stuff that it's a little bit of, it has to be all in your head, right? It's like, just like anything. If you wake up and say today's going to be a good day, it's a good day.
Yeah.
And if you wake up and say it's a bad day, you're right.
Yeah.
And I think that the audio stuff actually works that way too. If it's in your head that this specific record and I cleaned it and I put it on there and I got a fresh needle, it is already in your head that this is going to sound good and you're going to enjoy the hell out of it.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not and I don't care what it is you like doing. You like putting a fish down your pants, it brings joy to your life, do it, you know. But and if you want to, you know, clean all your records and put the needle on and then, you know, listen to it, do it. That is the thing to do. It's just like we get into trouble, I feel like, with myself and other people when we start saying like what's better. Because now you've got some sort of weird qualitative thing. Is it better for you? Awesome. It's better for you, but universally better across the board? I don't know. Like, there's a lot of things. People saying that they can hear certain compressions, which when I know for a it's the same thing with like whiskeys. Oh, this is better, that's better. Or even beer. Take the lowest.
Yep.
Like people bitching about domestic beer, you know, saying that, you know, Bud Light versus, you know, any other like light beer that you could. I would love to have a party where it's nothing but cheap domestic beers, all blinded. And then people actually find out what they really like.
That'd be amazing. Well, I think
you could sponsor that.
Let's do it. We got an event tonight.
Well, yeah. Why not start now?
Line them up. So that actually brings me to those kind of ideas, which is what are you into, what are you not into, and really thinking about. I've been saying this thing more and more, which is it's not for me. So I used to sit and have these arguments with my friends, like this band is better than this band,
right?
This whiskey's better than this whiskey, this beer's better. That was my entire upbringing. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of my best friends, we became friends because we could talk about these kind of things till 4 a.m. and still, you know, stand up and give each other a handshake.
Yeah.
But it was a spirited debate. And more, it's almost not even interesting anymore. It's like you're into your thing, I'm into my thing, and convincing anyone otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, convincing somebody who doesn't want to be convinced, what's the point? I don't even get it. I mean, I used to be really adamant about politics, and that probably comes with youth, right? That is the ultimate one. Where now I'm like, oh, really? You know, and I would really just spend all night talking about politics. But I guess it's maybe it's a time domain thing. After a little bit more time, you're supposed to do your thing. You're supposed to contribute in your way. But then I was like, well, why am I? I don't really even like politics. Why am I talking about? Why don't I make an argument for waveforms or something that I actually do like? You know, and then spend your time doing that. You know.
Yeah, exactly. So. You're arguing about stuff you're not even.
I don't even care about that much.
Yeah, I used to talk about how much I didn't like movies and try to argue about it in a way that was convincing to go, this is actually why. And now I just realize it's not even fun to talk about. We don't have to talk about movies. We could just talk about something else. And I don't know if that's a getting old thing or whatever, but something in my head was just like, you know what? I'd rather just have a normal conversation with you than argue.
I would rather know something that you didn't tell anybody, you know, or let's talk about something that is like, it's just, that's the problem with most of those conversations. I've had those conversations 20, 50, 100 times, and it's not, and maybe that's what getting old is having that same conversation, but and
like, the conversation.
Let's just be honest. There's somebody who's actually old out there that's looking at us right now and being like, shut up, you're not even old. But I mean, I'm just going to defend it for this industry. This is ancient. Like somebody in their 40s, I'm 41 right now. That's about as old as it gets, I think, before you. I don't even know what they do with old people.
In motion graphics?
Yeah, motion graphics. You just stop getting hired or
you just end up in the computer and they're banging on the screen.
Something like that.
Well, I saw this coming when I was young, which was there were nobody above no one above 35, yeah. Nobody above 40 did this job. And I started asking, like, what happens? And they go, they leave because you either have to become a manager or something like
sure.
that. So they either
start your own company, yeah, sort of thing.
You start your own company, mm-hmm. or you become not a motion graphics artist. You mm-hmm. end up managing a team.
Right.
And they basically, it was a money thing. You get to a family situation where you have a family to support, and now you can't just buy beer and whiskey and rent your apartment anymore. And you kind of have to transition out.
I'll just never become a family man for that very reason.
Right.
Just I made my choice early on. I'm like, I got to give up what for what?
Right. So as aging motion graphics artists, what's been your transition through that? Like, you started freelancing.
About 10 years ago.
Were
actually,
you always freelancing?
No, I was not always freelancing. I started freelancing maybe in about 2004, and that was somebody pulled me aside and said, "Hey, you should actually be freelance." You know, I think most people, if you aren't freelance, there's a freelancer that pulls you into freelance. Somehow it's
like
seductive, don't you think?
Kind of pulls you in. Yeah.
That's like, hey, that's this is what's this lifestyle? Or I mean, you talk to somebody, it's like, hey, I would like to. I think that, freelance has been the lifestyle for me. I really, really like it. I have, I mostly get to spend my day doing what I want to do.
Yeah.
More so than any other way I could think of. I don't know how to do it. I mean, and I don't even actually know if it's more free than, like, starting a company and then being responsible for people, because
I would assume so.
I think it is a little bit, even though you have a little bit more control as like the owner of a studio or something, you also have more responsibility. So it gets kind of weird, you know, but.
How was that transition for you? Because I think there's a lot of people maybe listening to this that their friends are freelance, or they see a lot of free.
Right.
It's becoming a bigger thing, it seems like, too. A lot of even studios around are hiring less full-time people in general and just relying on freelance. So it seems like, not only is it an individual, at least in Chicago, it's not even just an individual's choice. It's even culturally, it's happening more and more that the studios are like, we don't have to pay you full time. We don't have to pay your health insurance. We don't have to always keep you busy.
Right, but then they do that weird permalance thing where they keep you, but then they don't give you the benefits and then also pay
too.
You less. So
that's
at least
too.
In New York. So
so how was that trend in 2004? What made you go, let me try this? Or did you see somebody doing it that pulled you in?
So I already had a staff job, and then there were a bunch of freelancers there. So then one of the guys that was staff said, hey, you should leave as a staff position and then ask for a freelance position. And then I made a case for it. I went in and told them what I wanted and what I needed. And this ball-breaking lady was like, oh, no, we just can't do that for you. You know, we know that you're really valuable, but, you know, can't help you or anything like that.
You made the case to freelance for the same company where you were.
Yeah, for the exact same company.
That's interesting.
Which is, there's a lot of people that are staff at a place, and then they leave, and then they get asked to come back, you know, time to time, you know, or whatever that is.
They know how you work. They trust you, and you're already on their phone.
Yeah.
Like, let's see if Mike's...
The benefit at the time, it was much easier to freelance or go freelance back then, just because, again, responsibilities were way low. I just don't remember. I was also not making very good money at the time, and I guess I didn't need it, and just overhead was really low, and I just didn't mind a certain bohemian type of lifestyle, and it fit that. But the I also ran into a studio that I'm still with, a bunch of guys that were just like just starting up, only getting, you know, $500 here, $1,000 there for a job. I mean, we weren't even paid by the hour or by the day. You got paid by the job. Hey, can you come up with enough content? $500 worth of content. It was such an arbitrary, like, I mean, and that's,
that's ridiculous.
It is what it is. But, when you're starting out, that's, I mean, nobody really tells you the business rule. The business people didn't know. They were, kind of putting it all together at the same way that, we were trying to figure it all out. But it wasn't my favorite part about this story is that when I went freelance, all of my friends were like, I just don't know if I could do that. It's just like, I lose the security of like having a full-time position. And that company, it was a huge company owned by a global company. It was like one of those, there's only like a few, you know, about IPG and all that, anything with like three letters in it.
They just own it.
There's just like maybe, there's IPG and there's someplace else. It's like two companies that have so many sub-companies going on, right? And then even those sub-companies, they'll just buy some graphic studio and that will be now theirs, you know. But you'll just be making whatever, you know.
A subset of
nonsense. That was also the first place I ran into pharmaceutical work, which that was also the last time I did any pharmaceutical work. I was like, this is the one thing I'm not going to do. I'm going to pick one thing. I know people that have said no to, like, people that have and haven't done things for fracking or oil or whatever, or Fox News or,
you know. Cigarette stuff in Chicago.
Whatever you feel passionately about. There's a lot of it that I'm like, you know what? You know, you could take the position as like a lawyer that's like, I need to give the best defense to my client no matter what. No, and lawyers have no problem saying that. But I think within our industry, we realize how much we can brainwash people. And at some point, I hope everybody gets to a point that they can find something that they say no to, because there is something worth saying no to. There is something worth saying no to.
But you're saying pick one, though.
Maybe, yeah, just pick one. Just pick one, right? And then when that comes around, it's easy to... I mean, as a freelancer, it's easy to do. As staff, obviously, you can't do it.
Yeah.
But I saw a bunch of nasty things on the inside that I didn't really like too much. And the amount of money, even back then, was absurd. And the... but anyway, the short version of this is that everybody was saying, don't leave. You're going to... You know, there's... you're going to lose security and everything. And... I think it was less than maybe 6 months, maybe a year later, they just disbanded the design thing, and everybody that was staff got fired.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I had already started my freelance career and was safe at that time.
Yeah, so actually in that way, you're more in charge of what you're working on and more secure than...
There's a rule about security that there's no such thing as security. You have to create your own security. Just because you've got a full-time job, that's not secure. That's no more secure than being freelance.
Wow.
And... yeah, tough lesson, but
that's that's happening more and more. You actually brought up New York. Is it not as much freelance in New York? Because it feels like in Chicago that a lot of people are doing that. Maybe it's just my friends and I'm seeing it from my corner. But it seems like there's a lot of freelance people are grabbing whoever's open and just creating little teams and making stuff.
Well, we're all seeing things from our own corners, right?
Yeah.
And like I mean. Half a dozen shops in New York have I worked for. You know, it's really not a wide range. But I talk to a lot of people, and you know, freelancers talk to freelancers. So what I see is what I would probably do if I owned a company. I go to non-American labor that wants to get into the United States and kind of bribe them a little bit with a green card, and maybe get their paycheck pretty low, just to make sure that I could keep them. Or I hire people that are incredibly young, you know, that that I just don't need. I'm going to gamble that the experience that somebody has is less valuable than getting it, you know, something out today, just, you know, from, you know,
there seems to be those two, there's not only two, but those types of companies that are like, well, we're just going to rely on new, inexperienced but passionate kids that are learning this stuff on the internet, and we're just going to scoop them in and have them make stuff. And then there's the ones that are like, we're gonna pay for it, and we're just going to get it done quickly. You know, is that?
I've only worked for a couple of places where, and I've only heard, and I can. There's sometimes when you see other people's work where you're like, well, you've got to be a house full of experts. Like, there's just no way that the chumps make it across the floor. You know. But anywhere you can cut costs, I mean, it just costs so much. And in, I mean, New York City specifically, it's just absurd, you know, how much it costs.
I always joke, you know, we have an online software business, basically. and everything we do, we could sell and sell software. And I'm like, man, it'd be really hard to have a hot dog stand. It'd be really hard to, like, actually sell. It'd be so hard to sell a physical item that I'd have to restock on the shelf. I mean, even that freedom that we have. And then I think it'd be really hard to have a hot dog stand in New York. Like, all the costs and all the amount of stuff, and yet it still happens.
Yeah.
Like, all over that city, like, there's boutiques everywhere. There's shops everywhere, and it actually works. And somehow the math works out where you have to charge a certain amount to own a building or rent a building in New York.
The renting is probably the most expensive part, and it is ridiculous. But like our industry having no overhead whatsoever, like, well, not whatsoever, but you need a computer and you need some software and you need electricity and you need time. And that's it. But like after you've invested in computer software, it's really just about like time. Like how much time does it take to do anything?
And it's relatively inexpensive as a thing to get into.
Yeah.
If you want to get into woodworking,
right,
go price that out.
Right.
Like you need the space, you need the tool, you need the raw materials, you need all. And once you build a chair, you got to go buy more wood to go build a chair. Once you have the tools and the time, and you're saying exactly this.
Uh-huh.
You're done. You could just make all you want with the software and the computer that you have.
And not only that, but who's to say after you build that first chair you didn't screw it up and then that was completely, just got to throw it out. You got to build a brand new chair because it didn't work, you know?
Can't start over.
You can just undo and, you know just start from just do new file and it costs you nothing. But I had that same feeling. I walked by a bicycle shop and I'm just thinking about this because I just bought a studio or am renting a studio space with a friend now. And we were thinking about like, is this worth the money? To put into this. And actually, that's something that might be interesting. I'll finish my sentence. But then we walked by a bicycle shop, and I was like, man, what if I had to actually buy bicycles that people had to see to make a choice and, like, or to pick it up, and or if not...
Test drive it.
Yeah, any of those. And then, like, how many bicycles do I have to repair to make all this happen? And just the overhead is just ridiculous, and we're really lucky. But the thing that's been the most interesting to me is that, like, after all of this time now... and with more computers or, at this point, I was like, what could I do that is going to improve my path right now? Is to buy more computers, buy more software, do any of that stuff? And it wasn't any of those things. It was getting a space with a friend of mine because I can only do so much in my room. And a lot of people got to do stuff at home in their own apartments, and stuff like that. But the collaborative nature of being just two people in the same space, I mean, or even more, better. But like the ideas that are coming off of that, I was like, this is the best investment. This is better than getting a new computer, is being in the same space with another human being who's also an expert, at what they do, and just getting that to grow. And like, how would you, but nobody really talks about that as an investment, And there's also the stuff that, work, if, getting freelance jobs other places, there's stuff coming in, there's deadlines going out, and you don't always get the time to research or to play like the way you would like to. And if I don't research or play in this industry anymore, there's no point for me. Like, that was the thing that was really attractive about it in the beginning. And if that goes away, then I have no, there's nothing left for me.
You see the space as part of that research.
Where absolutely.
You can bounce an idea off, or somebody else is maybe into something that you're not naturally into, and you're like, oh, that's, you could play off each other in that way. I didn't think of it that way. Space is like necessary evil sometimes. Like, I guess we need a bathroom and a fridge now.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you approached it as a creative tool.
Absolutely.
Wow.
It is a creative tool. There's just no way around it. And the sort of things that only had it for about 3 months now, but like in that time, just blown up, like all kinds of ideas. And maybe none of them, there were some arguments back and forth with Chase and I. He said, maybe we should work on something that's that we know is going to be lucrative. I'm like, that's what research is. You don't know what's going to be lucrative. You have to spend time working on things that frivolously to really benefit, to find something that, and plus, if you're doing that, Every moment that passes, you never get any of it back. So you really better enjoy doing what you're doing. If you're laboring through your research time and your fun time, then you may as well.
Oh, that's an important distinction. Are you getting through the boring stuff to eventually do one fun thing?
Yeah.
And if that's your day, are you doing the right thing with your day?
Yeah.
Whereas you enjoy the process of it. I mean, I've always enjoyed that about you in general, is you will bring whatever you're into your work. Like I said about the audio stuff that you're working on, it was really cool to it's obvious that you're seeing things from the outside and pulling it into a world and enjoying it. And there are too many people that hate that hate their day, and you seem to always really really enjoy this kind of stuff.
I was at an impasse for the for Half-Rez, you know, I was trying to put things together, and I was like, well, you know, I got some things that people might want to see, and it'll make them, you know, maybe it'll make them look at cinema a different way. And then, and half of it is what I thought the audience would like, and the other half was what I thought was really passionate about. And I almost gave up, and it was just like, well, just give the audience what they want. And I was like, this is such an awesome opportunity. Don't get to do this very often, where you get to express your passion. And how do you know until you've put it out there what people like or don't like? You're just going to be doing the same old thing. So I'm really looking forward to sharing it tonight. It may just be nothing but crickets. I can't wait to see. It could be a total failure.
I
but,
doubt that.
We'll see.
I've seen you present before. It's never crickets. It's always interesting. And I mean, I alone just appreciate the passion you bring to it. It's why... I mean, when I've told this story to different people. I'm not sure if it's ever recorded, but when I met you, you were the nicest guy online, sharing his scene file. Huh. You know, I knew your name, Mike the Monkey, and then, like, he's here.
No, he called me Mike the Monkey back then. Just the Monkey.
Yeah, Monkey.
I'm just saying. Well, Maxon changed it to Mike the Monkey.
Did they?
Yeah, because I was anonymous for a long time. I just got to be the Monkey, and nobody knew my name. I didn't have it registered anywhere online. And then my first NAB presentation,
they said
Mike the Monkey Sempton. Dang, and I was like, oh, now I'm so Googleable.
Now I screwed it up.
No, it's too late. So done. That's like.
Well, I saw you, and I'm like, that's Mike. Wow, that's the Monkey. That's cool. I'm like, damn it, he's so handsome.
Really?
And I'm and then I'm like, well, and then you get up to teach. I'm like, damn it, he's a good teacher too. This guy's got it all. It's great work. Sharing, giving, the way that you explain things the whole time. I'm just sitting there like, this Mike guy's got it all.
Dude, I thank you for the compliments, but it's all shoulders of giants situation where, like, I had great teachers. I had fantastic teachers, and what I try to do when I'm explaining anything to anybody is embody my favorite teachers that really inspired me. That stuff just gets handed down. You don't do anything new yourself. Like, it's just not – you learned it from somebody, you know.
Maybe we should wrap up after this too, but that is – as you say that, it goes off in my head exactly right. Like, I teach the way that my favorite teachers did, really hands-on and really starting from scratch and plain language and all the things that I hold high in education and teaching and all the stuff, all the tutorials that we do comes from – I could picture them every time I do certain things. I'm like, they it worked for me. I learned well from them, and therefore I'm gonna use that as well. So maybe we'll end with this. What are a few things specifically teaching wise that you think comes from your favorite teachers you still do?
I got a couple of them. One was Mr. Wickman, who was my my math teacher in high school. I think I took analytic geometry and maybe calculus from him. And he would always talk about every single time. He's like, it's not so much what's happening, it's the notation. And you'll see tonight, like, it's really all about, like, not the thing, how you're viewing the thing. Because the truth is, you can view anything in multiple ways. That actually isn't that much different from another favorite teacher of mine, Ron Willis, who always said, I don't want to know what you know. I want to know how you know what you know. Which is now asking you to not just think, but think about your thinking, like how you're pulling the information in.
And how did you decide on this?
Yeah, and being discriminatory about certain things and just not letting any of that necessarily pass.
Right, that's kind of moving away from a definition of something and moving towards why we have definitions. Like, so to read a dictionary is not as interesting as, like, why that word is what it is, or why we use certain words or whatever.
Well, and he was my script analysis teacher, and I may have shared this with you before, but he would, there was a, like, we'd start off by reading a play, and the play opened up by butler being on stage with a lady. Lady asked the butler, where's Mr. Thomas? And the butler says, well, he's in the garden. And then he would turn to everybody, he'd be like, okay, well, where's Mr. Thomas? And everybody would say, he's in the garden. He's like, is he in the garden? All you know is that the butler said he was in the garden. So it's really about, like, not jumping too many steps of assumption and really seeing what happens. But as a good playwright, you're relying on those assumptions. You're trying to get people to assume things, and you're actually trying to trick them into that so that you can, you know,
manipulate their expectations.
Right, create a puzzle one way so that when it's the other direction, they're like, oh, I didn't think that was going to happen, you know?
Those are the best stories too, right? Yeah. You got all the way down the path, and you get to the end, and there's a wall.
Yeah.
It's all the way on the other side now. So you have it sounds like learning to know what you know and how you know it and kind of analyzing your own mind. Mm-hmm. And you teach that way all the time, mm-hmm. which I love. And the other one is...
notation, the way you're approaching something, the way you... I think that actually came from calculus was developed simultaneously by Leibniz and Newton. Okay. And so you got two different guys, and this is like everything that is monumental is happens usually multiple places on the earth at once. Two people are doing the same thing.
Yeah, light bulbs, same thing.
But they went at it completely different ways. So he would show sometimes how to use the notation of one dude, and then the other one, you know, depending on what the problem was, because he's like, this makes more sense here, this makes more sense here, even though you could force your way through, you know, either way.
Well, and that kind of is... what's going on with software and in general today. It's mm-hmm. you can't just rely on one tool. You really have to step back. And a lot of artists are doing this now. They're like, well, they're not V-Ray people. They're not whatever people. They're whatever tool works for this job. You know, really looking at it from what notation, you know, what do we use for this project that makes the most sense for this project, and not just fitting it all into whatever you know.
Yeah.
So that's the whole podcast. I got to make a separate podcast all about how people learned and their favorite teachers and the things that they pass on, because it's all learning.
Yeah.
Like everything we're doing.
I got one more from my physics teacher. Most of my teachers that I remember are actually from high school, which is, I guess that's maybe because that's when you're the most impressionable, or, I mean, who knows? I don't feel like I was listening at all either. when I was in high school, I feel like.
Minor early high school. Yeah.
But my physics teacher said, I was even going to mention this in the presentation tonight, was that he's like, there's no geniuses. Nobody's a genius. And anybody who tells you that there is a genius and that they invented something, they didn't. All they did was they took two different ideas and they put them together. And if you look at any of the geniuses that are out there, all they did was don't try to find something new that doesn't exist that you're going to invent. He's like, find two different things that nobody else brought together and then bring those two things together.
Wow.
And that's I found that to be mostly true over time. Do you find yourself sounding almost, you know, how your parents would maybe say something and then you sound like your parents after a while? And then now you're sounding like your teachers by saying something.
Absolutely. I mean, I have one in my head in particular, Mr. Schutz. He was an ex-hockey player, you know, slick back hair, tough Italian guy. And the way he taught was so visual and so story-based that I still can remember things to this day that I don't need. I just don't need to know. But he would describe things in the my perfect one is the first day of his class for geometry, or it was trigonometry, and he goes, today you're going to find out how high the flagpole is, and you're going to do it without actually measuring the flagpole. And he goes, I'll give you a hint, it's sunny out. We're all like, he's like, it's in the first chapter, you guys can find it, have a good day. And he, you know, we had a classroom full of stuff. There were protractors up on his desk. We're like, all right, we're figuring this out. And finally, we had to go research it in the book and kind of collaborate together as a classroom. And he didn't say a word the rest of the day. And we all kind of tried to figure out what he meant. And it ended up that we had to measure the shadow of the flagpole, mm-hmm. and then find the angle of from the shadow to the top, kind of eyeball it, do some math. Do some trigonometry,
some math.
and see how accurate.
How's your trig?
It worked. Yeah. I still remember it. I mean,
yeah.
By the end of that,
you can measure a flagpole right now.
I think I'll do it right now.
It's not a very sunny day, unfortunately.
SOA, COH. Like I got all of it, and because of him, because of the visual way. Because if I just read that in a book and I had to do the math problems because this is what I have to do to get past the class, I would have done fine, and it would have disappeared. Just like most other things I learned. But something about the way that he taught was very visual, and he explained why we needed to learn these things. It stuck with me. So those are the things when I try to explain my work very succinctly, or I talk too much, that's not succinctly, but very visually, I have him in the back of my head all the time, because I think that works. You're not just clicking this button because I told you to. You're clicking this button because now you know what this button does, and... You can use it into the future.
How does that, well, how do you differentiate somebody who isn't helpful as a teacher? How does that make them a good teacher or a bad teacher? Because it sounded like he wasn't helping you. You, like, had to teach yourself.
Yeah.
Which is, I would say that one of my best teachers ever is my father, who taught me to be self-reliant, you know? And that's a really good lesson to learn. But at the same time, that could be considered cruel.
He wasn't always that hands-off. Okay. That was just day one.
Just the flag day.
I think it stands out because usually day one is the teacher going through the class.
Right.
We're going to talk about this, and let's do that. And, oh, here's the syllabus. And it's all boring stuff day one. And instead what he did was he goes, we're going to solve a problem today. That's what this class is going to be about.
Love solving problems.
And I go, and me, I was the dumb kid. I mean, I was the kid everyone yelled at because I wanted only story problems. I'm like, can we just do the story problems? And the kids are like, shut up. And I'm like, they make it sense to me. Everyone else wanted to, it seemed to me, wanted to just do the formula.
Really? Yeah. Nobody likes story problems. That's really odd.
And I wanted a whole book of story problems. Like Johnny went, like the trains coming at each other. Yeah. I could do those problems all day because I could visualize them and they had a point. And I was such a jerk kid. I actually told one of my, after having that incredible math teacher, I had an awful math teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember leaving her class, I'm like, if I solve for X one more time in this class, I'm out. I'm leaving. She goes, that's all this is.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is all it is. We solve for X.
I need to solve a problem. Like, uh-huh. We need to bounce a basketball in here, or I'm going to go bonkers. Like, I need to figure out what the goal is. Because if we just have an arbitrary number that we're solving for, I am not interested at all.
Well, speaking about that particularly, that goes along with Mr. Wickman and notation. Although I love math, I cannot stand the way math is shared between people right now. It is cryptic. It's elitist in a way. And the thing is that everything I'm going to pretty much talk about trigonometry tonight, okay. But I'm mostly going to show pictures. And if you don't understand it, you come back and you tell me if you don't understand it. But I have a feeling that I can show you a single image that will put a lot of trigonometry together really quickly, because you immediately understand images and things moving through the passage of time. Your body already knows what it is. You know, drawing all these weird, squiggles, and even the way they're put together, it so could use a revamp. Musical notation, also, yeah. You know, something we've talked about that before. It was great to do tiny little dots when all we had was a tiny little pen and had to look through bars and stuff like that. But I mean, with all of our capabilities, with user interface and stuff like that, we can't find something that's more modern, you know, a better way to understand it. We've done so well at other things, although nothing's
coming to mind.
I think
we're going through that in all things, even especially with computers, where you aren't, nothing's dictated by past. Nothing needs to be dictated by the past, because each pixel we can change as mm-hmm. far as visuals, right? So music notation
right.
was there because it was compact. It was
right.
on one sheet. Mm-hmm. And now we have the ability to do whatever on the screen that we want.
Right.
I think interface, like all, even just think about Pro Tools or keyframing in general. That's all, you know, left to right, and it's all dots and volumes going up. And a lot of it is intuitive, but a lot of it's not.
Yeah.
It's a lot of it's holdover from music stuff, right? A lot of it's holdover from editing software, and it's all been pushed forward. And I think a lot of things can go through that that change. And it's a lot of education. It's a lot of showing people that there's a different way to do it. But you see software pop up all the time, even iPhone apps, that totally have a different interface that does music.
And people learn it so quickly if it is intuitive, you know. And that's the thing, is like, do you make it intuitive?
And it would make somebody that studied music go bonkers.
Yeah.
They would go, what am I doing?
Because you did all the work on it. You know, it makes me bonkers. Apple makes me bonkers with all the new features they try to put in. And I'm like, I can rock a terminal. Like, I can just put commands into this and make things happen.
Right.
But, and so, I mean, I get it. But there's definitely things I would never want to go back to. That, you know, like, I don't actually really want to work in a terminal window 100% of the time. In fact, the first 3D, I don't know if the first 3D I did was with code in Pavre.
Wow.
I don't know if you've ever coded, like, it was all just reflective balls on a plane and stuff like that.
I love
it. stripes. They didn't have that. It was only checkers. But it was so tedious, and I can't believe that anybody would do it if they had the choice.
Well, I think we're lucky that we live where we do now and just take your whack 'em and make some stuff move.
Yeah.
I'm realizing we could talk forever.
Probably.
We should probably wrap this up and we'd have to have you back.
Yeah.
Mike, it's so good to have you here.
Dude.
I really appreciate it.
Of course you do.
Have fun tonight. Of course you do.
I'm going to have a great time, man. I really appreciate bringing me out here. This is going to be really fun.
We're excited to have you.
Yeah.
Talk to you. What, how do you end these things?
I don't know. Scene.
High five.
If I have to.
Thanks, Mike.
Sure, you bet.
Okay. That was awkward at the end. I like it.